Well, what do we talk about this semester? We might as well begin, because if we begin early, we can also leave early. Not really, but... Welcome to the spring semester, 2009. This is CS310, Object-Oriented Programming with Java. I am pleased to see all familiar faces here, which means that I can more or less run through the boilerplate very quickly, since we've all gone through it at least once before. I think everybody's gone through it once. Why don't we do that? This is an introductory course on object-oriented programming in Java, and I will have lots more agony about this when I'm done with the boilerplate. The prerequisites for this class are CS305. It would be very helpful if you had software engineering. How many people have had software engineering? Which I believe is 325? Yes, I know you three did. Oh, how did that go? How did your talk go? I was going to go, but then I forgot. You got really sick during the talk? Or?
Actually, yeah, right at the talk.
Excellent. That's always adds interest to the talk. It was, what, some kind of hardware store?
Yeah.
Well, I had it in mind to go, but unfortunately, with my mind, that isn't enough. I have to write it down someplace. So. All right, well, software engineering will be helpful for reasons that we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. Although, again, if you haven't had it, that's fine, too. The course is divided into 14 one-week sections, so we're going to be moving along at a quick pace in this class. I'll talk a little bit about the syllabus. I have not, or the schedule, I have not printed out a copy of this. Well, I have my copy of the schedule, but I haven't printed out copies for everybody else. You can pick them up later if you want. I'll just say a little bit about the schedule. The class meets here on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 2 to 3:50. And I'm going to try, since there are six people in this class, I will try and see if we can get downstairs, which has a bigger table, so there's more room. But if that's not the case, then we'll continue to meet here. This is kind of cozy, not too bad. There's no class during spring break, which is the 12th and 10th and 12th of March, which I believe is the second week. Last day of class is Thursday, the 30th of April. There are three objectives in this class, principally. And again, as you know, I have hidden secret objectives, which pretty much are the same as they were last semester. In fact, they're always the same. But I'll say a little bit about those two later. So the three principal objectives are to know the sequential Java programming and some of the more common libraries. So we are not going to cover here concurrent programming in Java. That's a different class. Have an understanding of the basic object-oriented concepts, what object orientation means, what it is you do when you do object-oriented programming, what you can expect to get out of it when you do it correctly, and to be familiar with facilities, Java facilities, for doing graphics programming and user interface programming, in particular the AWT and Swing libraries, as well as applets. We'll cover all of those. There are some other things that we'll talk about. I'll mention those as we go along. I hope you're all familiar with me. My office is right next door in the adjunct's office. Office hours are not from 5 to 6. They are from 1 to 2 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So they're right before class. Also, I don't have anything to do after class. I can also be here after class, too. Grade ranges, again, the gradings in effect, you've all had it inflicted on you. Anybody have any questions about that? All right, I don't have to go through all the... there was actually something I had thought of. Oh, I was thinking of different scales. I gave you my scale, the way that A works. A is correct answers. B is sort of correct answers. C is nice try. I was thinking of other kinds of scales that you might use. And the only actual one I could think of really was in terms of hiring. A would be someone I would hire. B would be someone I would not hire. And C would be somebody I don't even know why they're looking for a job, at least in this area. But I figured that wasn't very useful. Although it is actually a useful way to think about things, if a little mercenary. All right, what does your grade come from? From what does your grade come? It comes from 25% quizzes, 25% writing assignments. This is a writing intensive class, as we'll discuss in a couple of minutes, and 50% programming assignments. This is a programming class. You are going to be writing programs, and you are not going to get out of here alive if you don't write programs. Half your grade is programming. And because this is object-oriented programming, it's actually a little bit more than just programming. We'll start to edge into the idea of system structures. So it's not merely just programming. It's thinking about how you would write interfaces, thinking about how you use interfaces, what interfaces are, one of the things we'll discuss, and interfaces in the non-technical term, although there is, for those of you familiar with Java, the technical term for interfaces, too. These, in addition, apart from the 25-25, 50% weighting, there's no other weightings involved. So each quiz, all your quizzes are a straight unweighted average. All your writing assignments are a straight unweighted average, and your programming assignments, too. Midterm grades will be the straight unweighted average of whatever quiz, writing, and assignment grades you've accumulated up to the midterm grade deadline, which is the 10th. Of March, Monday. Now, wait a minute, let me go back here and look at something. Now, if you are paying attention, you will notice that I said back when we talked about the schedule, there's no class during spring recess Tuesday, the 10th of March, and I've just told you that Monday, the 10th of March, is when your midterm grades are due. So I'll have to fix that one too, although right offhand, I don't know which one is wrong. Anybody know? Okay, well, one of those two is wrong. But in any event, whenever your midterm grades are due, then whatever grades you have up to that point will be what your midterm grades are. Quizzes. There will be, now it says here 13 quizzes, and I'm wondering why that's, man, I thought I proofread this thing. There are 13 quizzes, and I'm wondering why that's not 14. I know I had trouble with the number of one-week sections in this class because there is the spring break week in there. So we have 15 weeks, but only 14 of them will actually be meeting. But here it says there are, which means that then there should be 14 quizzes. But it says 13. So I will have to check and make sure why that says that. You're all familiar with the quizzes. Excuse me. They'll be pretty much the same as they were last semester, except that there will only be two questions as opposed to four questions, and you get a half an hour as opposed to an hour. They will be on Thursday, the first half hour of class. And they will be pretty much devoted to your readings. The quizzes will be pretty much ripped out of the book, out of your readings. Not so much the things that we talk about in class, although I, of course, reserve the right to throw that stuff in. Although I notice here I say that it will take no more than 15 minutes to take the quiz, which is fine, too. That means we have more time to talk in class. But I'm trying to remember what I did last year. This will be the second time I've taught this course. You know, since you had 1 hour for four questions, if you only get two questions, then you get half an hour. But I guess the point was the questions were relatively simple, so maybe you only get 15 minutes. I'll have to think about that. We'll have to worry about that next week, not this coming up week. There will be 4 3-week programming assignments. That will start in the fourth week, so we're going to skip the first 3 weeks, and then your first assignment will begin on the fourth week. And again, you can look at the syllabus for details on that. Writing assignments. This will be a writing intensive course, and this satisfies one of your two gen ed requirements. I believe software engineering satisfies the other one. So you will have to do writing in this class, and we'll have to follow the the rules, which last time I looked were you need to write at least 20 pages, and you need to be able to, and you need to have the opportunity to rewrite your 20 pages. I'm not clear on how close we're going to stick to that. You certainly have the ability to rewrite, but it's not, I'm not really worried too much about the 20-page limit. The other thing is, I was wrestling, last time I taught this, last year, your writing essentially consisted of doing JavaDoc stuff, which we'll talk about when the time comes up. And the other alternative is to actually write things. So, for example, one thing, one possibility that someone mentioned is that you would write a page on what your readings were that week. And actually, that was, I like that idea. But on the other hand, the problem is that sort of really gets into the writing intensive part. So that assumes that I'm actually going to sit down and read your things and grade them for correctness and clarity. And then I'm actually going to come in and do something about it, like tell you that, as I've mentioned with respect to the quizzes, it's not a good idea to say this thing and not make it clear what you're referring back to. And quite frankly, I don't want to do that because it's not my competence, and I'd rather talk about other things. If you don't know how to write at this point, well, I'm certainly not going to bring you along in that case. So I like to think of it more as not necessarily sharpening the blade, but honing it once it's sharp. And if that's not the case, oh well. So I suspect what's going to happen is we are going to stick with the sort of geeky, JavaDoc-ish kind of writing, and that's what you'll be doing. So it'll be a highly stylized, structured kind of writing. Not quite what they had in mind when they were doing the Gen Ed requirements, I suspect, but oh well, that's life. All right, that's it for writing assignments. And they will essentially be concurrent with your programming assignments, delayed by one, which means that you're going to have, and that the delay by one part is the rewriting part. So you're essentially going to have three programming assignments. Sorry, you're going to have four programming assignments and three writing assignments. Was that clear? Or do I have to review that one too? All right, textbook. This is your textbook for the class. It's actually not a bad book. There are a lot. This book has two things wrong with it that I hate. First of all, it's about Java. Second of all, it's thick. I really hate thick books. But this is actually not a bad book, although this book is actually worse than the 7th edition, but this is the edition that's current. The difference between this book and the 7th edition is they took out the section on Stream.io, the chapter on Stream.io in this book, which is incomprehensible to me unless I'm not understanding the way Java programming is going in these times, which means that I'm going to have to put it back. So actually one of your readings will be something that I will give you, which is essentially I'm going to copy the chapter of Stream.io from edition 7 and give it to you. And by copy, I mean rewrite, so I won't get arrested for copyright infringement. And there are some other chapters in this. See, the nice thing is the 7th edition had 15 chapters, and we started at the beginning, we read through the end, and we were done. So at the end of the semester, you're able to say, wow, I read this whole book. But we're not going to be able to do that here because there are things at the end that we're not going to be talking about.
If you want to, can you look for the 7th edition of that book?
Let's see. Can you do that? Yes, the problem is going to be the chapters are not numbered the same. So that's fine. That's fine. You just have to do a little bit more work. In particular, there are some optional sections that you don't have to read if you don't want to. And I was fairly clear in, because I had this problem last year. Last year what happened was, okay, 7th edition. And in between the time I said 7th edition and we started class, the 8th edition came out. And that was the edition that they got in the bookstore. So everybody had the 7th edition except for me and a couple other people who either already had it or got it early. And that turned out to be a problem because people were drifting off, and I couldn't figure out why until I finally realized that this has different page numbers than the 7th edition. But if you can get a hold of the 7th edition, that's fine. Just keep in mind you're going to have to be a little bit careful about the mappings from page numbers to what you actually have to read. Not earlier than the 7th edition, however, because we are going to be discussing generics, and that is not was not introduced until Java version 6, I believe, and that's what 7th edition covered. So. Actually, I think I mentioned that here someplace. No, sorry. Java version 5. Man, I am off to a roaring start this semester, let me tell you. So Java version 5 contained the generics. 6 just had a bunch of other stuff, which is not of particular interest to general programmers. And 7, we don't have to worry about it at all because we're not going to see that. I also have an annotated bibliography about 4 books about Java, which you can take a look at. There are a few other books that I recommend you get that I'm going to be using as auxiliary books for this course. I didn't actually specify them. There they are. I'll talk about those when we're done talking about this. Okay, email, pretty much the same as it was last semester. Hypermail archive, again, I'll run that. This time it will actually work because I will be the instructor for this class as opposed to last semester, which in which case it didn't work because I wasn't the instructor, either because they canceled the class or I took over the class from somebody else. This semester it will work, although I didn't test it. Should have done that. So let me just put a little tick mark there. All right, and you all know how that works. Everything that you send that's of general interest goes to the Hypermail archive. If you don't want that, let me know explicitly, and I will make sure that that isn't the case. Homepage, this is the class homepage. Again, you're all familiar with it. Same setup as last time. There's a homepage, and then there's the schedule, and the schedule is the more important of the two, so that's the one you should bookmark. Podcast, it has gone beyond experiment. Last semester, I experimented with podcasting to see whether or not I talked too fast. And it turned out, at least in my opinion, I did not talk too fast. However, I discovered a lot of other problems I have. I think I have my little index card of things I should not do. No, I didn't bring it in. But I have this little index card of things I should not do. Some of you know what some of them are since we talked about it last time. So I will continue to podcast just to see if I can, as they say when you're waiting on the phone, improve quality control. Those will be available on the syllabus and on an RSS feed, which you can subscribe to. I did actually use a podcatcher, and it does appear to work, although I use some strange podcatcher, which other people don't, probably other people don't use. It seems that most people now put their podcasts on iTunes, which I refuse to do. But so you have either way. Did anybody actually listen to those last semester? I'm just wondering.
Read them last semester.
Okay, well, it was actually in the other class.
Yeah, I read or listened to them one day.
You did? I don't find them useful at all. Well, I mean, they're useful in the sense that I can listen and say, oh boy, that's stupid. You shouldn't do that anymore. But as to actually learning something, it just seems to me incredibly boring because I'm listening to other people. I go looking to see, how do other people teach Java? And so I've been listening to other people's podcasts, and it's not, I don't know, I find it underwhelming, but I don't know. Although I am actually listening to another course from UC San Diego about the history of modern art, which is pretty interesting. You sit there in front of Google Image, and as she talks about the backs by Matisse, you can Google them and see what she's talking about. It's actually kind of cool. And she's a pretty good speaker, too. Policy. Okay, so that's it. That's the specific part, although as you'll notice, it's fairly generic. Any questions about that? Again, it's pretty much what you were subjected to last semester, and you're going to be subjected to it again this semester. All right.
So it's either 13 or 14 quizzes?
Yes, you're going to have one a week. Except for spring break, which would lead me to believe that you're going to have 14, but I don't know why I wrote 13.
And then it's 3 writing assignments and 4 programming assignments?
Right. And the writing assignments, let's see, what was the big deal last semester? Oh, last year, the assignments were essentially in HTML. How many people do not know HTML? If I tell you to write, I don't know, 800 words on your favorite subject, would you be able to do it in HTML?
Like, what do you mean, just wrap it in the HTML
page? Yeah, have paragraphs and maybe section headings.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's all I want. Yeah. And there were some people last year just who couldn't do that. They didn't know what to do. That is my suspicion, what we are going to be doing. As I said, part of your writing will be in JavaDoc, but part of it will be specifying interfaces for things, and this interface specifications can either be in JavaDoc or in HTML. No Word documents, please. I don't know how to deal with those. So. Okay, policies. This is true boilerplate. Assistance, again, if you, and this wasn't the case last semester, if anybody has any need for special requirements, you can come and see me, and we will take care of them. Attendance policy is the same as it was last, same as it always is, same as it was last year, last semester. I have no attendance policy for class. You can attend or not as you see fit. But again, absence from class is not an excuse for anything. And in particular, if I say something in class, you're responsible for knowing it and acting upon it. So. And again, because I podcast things, assuming I'm not mean and cut those things out, then it's fairly easy to figure out how you can meet those requirements if you don't attend class. Although, as I indicated, it's perhaps more boring, but that's... Attendance, again, only applies to lectures. It does not apply to other things, such as principally the quizzes. Again, there is a class attendance policy that Monmouth University has, which requires me to take attendance. As I will attempt to demonstrate, I don't really need to take attendance for the reasons that I usually take it, although maybe I do, I don't know, I haven't actually done it yet. So I will actually take attendance, but again, that's entirely for Monmouth University's benefit. Cheating. We talked about cheating last year, and I didn't see that there were any problems with it, or at least there were problems that were not obvious to me, so in that case, that means there were no problems. I haven't actually quite figured out how to do this, but I would actually like people to work together. I was a little concerned when I saw that I only had 5 students, because then, of course, that's an odd number. But now that we have 6, then we can do like 3 groups of 2 or 2 groups of 3. So we may, in fact, I may actually jigger things so that people work in groups, which I think might be nice. But I'm not exactly sure how that would work with respect to, for example, the writing. For the programming assignment, it's fairly clear how that would work, but I'm not sure how that would work for the writing. And also, I'm not sure what you would do in terms of the groups. That would be the only sort of kicker in here about doing your own work when you're in a group. But again, just to remind you, my expectation is that whenever you hand in work, it is work that you have actually done. You have actually pulled out of your head and put down on paper or programmed in a machine, whatever. And if that's not the case, then that's cheating, and we have to deal with it. On the other hand, I would, even if I can't figure out how to group you, I would strongly encourage you to work in groups. Like I said, we're going to be moving at a fair clip in this class. We have a lot of stuff to cover, and some of it is actually fairly subtle, not the Java stuff, more the object-oriented stuff. And then tying the two together, object-oriented programming and Java, can be difficult. It's helpful to have someone you can work with, bounce ideas off of, ask questions of. And of course, I'm always here. I mean, you're paying for me, so. But have other people too. Late assignments. Nothing has changed there. We still have the. I still use that email system, although I actually am trying to move to a web-based system. That's taking fairly long time. I don't expect that we'll see that for this semester. I don't believe I had too much problem with late assignments. Well, not in 306 and not in 305 among the people here. We did have problems with late assignments, but not for the people here. So. But again, assignments are due, I believe, at 5:30. Or we can, and I can actually change that time to be whatever you want. I don't really care. And once they, once you submit after the deadline, then you lose 5 points a day. Up until some absolute deadline when you can no longer submit anything at all. I'll talk more about that when we go to the first assignment. since there's that very long page about how to turn in your assignments, which, again, you should all be familiar with. Although, actually, it's a little bit different this semester because you're using Java. You'll be using Java. 24-hour test, or 24-hour clock. Yeah. Okay. And finally, missing test again. There's a quiz every Thursday will be during the first either half hour or 15 minutes of class. And it would be best if you actually made it for those things. Because it's not, as you might expect, it's two questions. It's not a real big deal, so there's no particular advantage to blowing it off. It's not as if it's a major item. So just take it and be done with it. But also remember that the same rule applies in the sense that you have until the next quiz to make up the previous one. So if you miss a quiz, you have essentially just either the following Tuesday or the following Thursday to make it up. And if you don't, then you get a zero. And, of course, if you know that you're going to be out and away, then you let me know and we can just work something out. And there's a reference in the links section. You can learn object-oriented programming with Java at home. I didn't particularly like that course. I sat through it and watched it. I didn't think it was... I thought it was long and drawn out. So, all right, so that's it for the boilerplate. Any questions about that? All right, so let me go back and clean up some of these promises I talked about. The first thing is this course is actually not called Object-Oriented Programming with Java. If you go and look in the catalog or follow the link to the catalog reference, it's some very long name that contains Object-Oriented Programming and also contains Java. And I just threw away the extra words. So there's actually the actual name of this course is different from what I'm actually teaching. So there are essentially two things in this course, Object-Oriented Programming and Java. And when I taught this course last year, and that would be the first time I taught it, I had to think about which one I wanted to emphasize. It was clear to me I couldn't talk about both, because those are both fairly sizable topics. Although they're not completely independent, they are related, as I'll mention. So I had to figure out whether I should talk about both of them, and if not talk about both of them, which one I should emphasize more. And I decided that I probably could not talk about both of them. So I decided to stick with one of them, and one of the things I have written down on my index card is do not start sentences with so. Last semester it was do not start sentences with and. And I predicted that if I do that, I will start sentences with something else, and that something else is so. My card says two things. Do not start sentences with and. Do not start sentences with so. Where was I?
Couldn't do both.
I needed to pick one of them. Because there is a course in object-oriented programming, how many people have taken that? Is that in the schedule yet for you? Or?
I haven't taken it here. I took it up for object-oriented.
Okay, so you've already got a pass on that. But there is, actually, I'm not quite sure whether it's still around anymore. There is a course, I think maybe a 400-level course on object-oriented programming. So I said, fine, that will take care of object-oriented programming. I will just stick with Java. And what I pretty much taught last year was a Java course. And, of course, you can't talk about Java without talking about object-oriented programming. So from that point of view, if you're keeping track, I just did a sentence with and a sentence with so. Now I have to stop. And I forgot where I was again. Well, it doesn't matter, because what I decided for this semester, I'm actually going to throw object-oriented programming back into it. And in my head, the way I have this scheduled is, on Tuesdays, we're going to talk about Java. And then on Thursdays, we're going to talk about object-oriented programming features. Now, in some cases, I will have to get around that, because there are some sections where the topic that we're covering in Java is going to take the whole week. And ironically enough, when we get to actually classes and objects, that's probably going to take us all week. But for the other sections, I'm going to try and talk about object-oriented programming divorced from, but not independent of, Java. And towards that end, I'm going to, first of all, start a sentence with "and" again. But I'm going to use these two books as my guidelines, principally this book, which is Program Development in Java. This is a very good book. It's actually a second edition or revision, if you will, of a book that Liskov and Guttag wrote, oh, I don't know, maybe 20, possibly even 30 years ago, on abstraction and program development. And if you can ever find a copy of that book, I recommend you get it. It's a very good book. It contains the ideas of object-oriented programming in a much purer form because it used a language called Clue, which was specifically written to support object-oriented programming, as opposed to Java, which was kind of cobbled together. Although, it, you know, again, it's based on objects, they weren't perhaps quite as militant about following the object-oriented philosophy, or alternatively, they had a different object-oriented philosophy than many people have, and that shows up in the language itself. But this is actually not a bad book. So this is one of the principal books I'm going to be using when I talk about the object-oriented programming parts of object-oriented programming. And like the title says, it's related to Java, so it's still a useful book to have if you'd like to get that and study it. I will put references to the chapters I'm talking from in the lecture notes as references at the end. The other book is an old one. This was written in, I believe, 1988, which makes it, 20 years old. Oh, my God. They didn't even have computers then, did they? But I consider, up until recently, when I ran across a few other books, I consider this the best written book in object-oriented programming that I've read. So certainly for the past 20 years, this has been one of the best books. And I read a lot of books on programming languages because it's an area of interest of mine. And there have been a lot of books on object-oriented programming, and most of them have been junk because they don't really illustrate any significant thoughts about what's going on. They will tell you about things about classes and instances and all this other stuff, and they'll tell you the rules, but they don't evidence any understanding behind what's going on. And Bertram Mayer, as the person who wrote this book, actually does betray that knowledge. If you actually read his books, this is one of those early ones, you get the sense that he knows what he's doing, and furthermore, he knows why he's doing it, and he makes it clear why he's doing it. And there's a reason for that. He wrote an object-oriented system called Eiffel, which is one of the Eiffel Towers on the cover of that book, which I believe at this point is... He had a software company for, I don't know, maybe 20, maybe he still has it for that matter, 20 years or so, in which he tried to market Eiffel. And I guess it was reasonably successful more in Europe than it was here. It had some problems with it because he didn't take a real theoretical approach to the issues associated with object-oriented programming. And so he got into a little bit of trouble with the things he tried to do. But he did try and do the right things. He just didn't have the tools available to him to do them correctly. So this represents a really good book. And this book actually served to influence a lot of my thinking about object-oriented programming. As I suspect most of you know, I really don't like object-oriented programming. I think for the most part it's a failure. But to the extent that you can think about object-oriented programming in the way that Mayer does, and a few other people do, then I think it's very successful, including Liskov and Guttag. So these are the two books that I will be using with respect to the object-oriented programming part of the course when I talk about that. Again, you don't have to, there won't be anything other than the lectures, so the quizzes, there won't be anything on the quizzes in these books, just on this one.
These two are listed on the syllabus. Those are like the added.
These are in, they should be in the annotated bibliography, yeah. And if they're not, well, I'll check to make sure that they are. So let me put another little tick mark next to that. Tick. How many people here know Java? Well, let me put it this way. How many people have programmed in Java? A couple of people? All right, everybody else is not. Let's see, do I want to talk about anything else? No, so that's the principal difference between the way I'm going to try and run the course this semester and the way I ran it last year, is I'm going to try and include more object-orientedness in the class. although I'll try not to make it too confusing. And I don't think that will be the case, because we will have our anchor. I mean, we will be talking about Java. You will learn Java to a practical extent in this class, so you don't have to worry about that. But I'd like to perhaps make it a little bit less vocational, is the phrase that I heard used before, vocational than it was a year ago. Let me talk a little bit about the schedule. Again, I didn't print copies of this because you know how to get them. There are, like I said, 15 weeks. One of those weeks is spring break, so we don't have to meet then. Essentially, we're going to be reading a chapter a week. So this week it's chapter 1, next week chapter 2. Things switch around. I talk about chapter 4 and then chapter 3. Chapter 5 is an example of where you would have to be careful if you had edition 7, because you can skip various parts of chapter 5, and you just have to make sure. And in fact, I should probably rewrite this so that if you actually do use, do you have the 7th edition? Or?
No, I was just wondering.
Okay.
It'd be easier if it had that stuff in it that you were talking about. It's not in this one.
Well, from that point of view, because I am rewriting that chapter, it's going to be smaller, because I'm not going to rewrite the whole chapter. There are some things, if I'm remembering correctly, there are some things in that chapter that we don't need to talk about.
No, I should probably get that one.
Okay. This one has, let's see, what are the, I think there's threading in here as the extra thing. So what are the things we are not going to talk about? Oh, yeah, I mean, for example, strings. We're going to be spending a tremendous amount of time on strings because, well, not a tremendous amount of time, but certainly more time than you would expect, because strings, Java uses Unicode, and if you're familiar with using C and C++, they don't use Unicode. They just have characters. This is a character, but with strings in Java, they use Unicode, which is a little bit more complicated, so we're going to have to go through that. Generic programming, we're not going to do collections. We're not going to do multi-threading. They do have multi-threading. So we're going to skip those two, although you should actually read collections. Maybe I'll talk about those on and off. So we're not going to do the 13th chapter, and we're not going to do the 14th chapter. We're certainly not going to do the 14th chapter regardless. Collections actually might be useful to talk about at the end, because it, in a sense, would tie together the object-oriented kinds of issues that I'm going to be covering in this class. And pretty much whenever you go to an object-oriented system, you can expect, or your expectation should be, when you go to an object-oriented system, you should expect to see something like collection. All right, so now I'm sort of talking myself into teaching that chapter. Because when you go to an object-oriented system and they have libraries, what they claim to be libraries, you should expect to see something like collections, and you should have some expectations about how that library or set of libraries is arranged. And that's an example of the kind of object-oriented thinking I want to introduce in this class. So maybe we will talk about collections. I know at the 15th chapter or the 15th section is on scripting, which I thought was kind of nice, but we can perhaps pitch that over the side, because I think maybe it would be more important to understand about collections and what they are, not only with respect to Java, but like I said, setting your expectations for what it means to be an object-oriented system. For example, Smalltalk has the same thing. I just went through some Smalltalk code that dealt with the collection subsystem. They don't actually have libraries in Smalltalk, or at least not in the Smalltalk I was using. All right, I don't believe there's anything else I want to say about the schedule. Any questions? All right. I will say, bring your book in Thursday. Make sure you bring your book in, okay? With that, we can start talking about a first lecture. That's not going to work. Oh, this turned off, didn't it? We're going to start off by talking about Java. And that was actually one of the things I thought a lot about. Should you start off talking about object-oriented programming, or, because like I said, I'm going to try and have Tuesdays be Java, Thursdays be object-oriented programming. And then I said, well, what about making Tuesdays be object-oriented programming and Thursdays be Java? I decided that it would be best to have concrete things before more abstract things. So we'll be talking about Java and then object-oriented programming in the hopes that at least you would be able to have a better grasp of the concept of object-oriented programming, which tend to be more abstract if you had some idea of the way they can be realized in a particular programming language. So today we'll talk about Java, and then on Thursday we'll talk about object-oriented programming. I'll introduce Java, which actually turns out to be a little bit more complicated than you might expect. We'll go across some buzzwords, and this follows the first chapter in the book. We'll talk a little bit of history and then some clarification, some common misunderstandings that people have when they talk about Java. And the most interesting thing about Java is it's not just a language. It's a lot of things. It's a system. With respect to this class, as far as we're concerned, Java is three things. It's a language. This is going to be our principal interest. It's a language. It's a class library. I mentioned the collection part of the library. There are some other parts like the new I.O. library and some other things that we'll talk about. And that's a sizable library. There's over 3,000 classes in Java. Then, of course, there are other areas that we're not going to talk about, as I'll mention later on in this lecture, which would boost that number up probably double or perhaps even treble. And it's an execution environment, the JVM. This is actually, as far as I'm concerned, the most interesting part of Java is the JVM. And we are actually not going to talk pretty much at all about it. But these are the three things that we'll be dealing with for the most part in this class. But there's a lot of other things that are involved too. In particular, Java and as a realization in the JVM, Java represents a computational model, a way of carrying out computations. And that's a fairly rich computational model. There's a lot of interesting features in that model, in particular reflection, dynamic distributed computing, all kinds of issues associated with secure computing. There are a lot of interesting features in the Java computational model. We will not be talking at all about most of those things. We will not be talking about reflection at all. We may actually talk a little bit about the dynamic aspects of computing in Java, particularly with respect to the idea of a class path and classes, loading classes, but we're not going to go into any detail about that. And we're not going to talk at all about security because I avoid security, Java security, like the plague. Oh, and it's a security model, which I decided to break out. Verified bytecode, sandbox execution in particular. It's also a protocol set. There are a lot of protocols associated with Java. There's the Java native interfaces, remote method invocation, serialization, all kinds of things. And there are also subsystems associated with Java. There's the Gini subsystem for doing distributed communication, the JXTA, which is the, what is it called, peer-to-peer portion of Java. There's the Java Beans, which is the sort of enterprise server-side computing subsystem in Java. So there's lots of other aspects of Java that we're not going to talk about, but which do make up the Java system. And these things will actually be important when you go out into the world and actually start working, since this is where all the heavy lifting gets done. But for us, we are actually, if we mention them at all, are only going to mention them glancingly. So the first thing you should say when someone asks you about, whoa, do you know Java, is you should say, which part? Because there's a lot of it. We can draw another picture, or a picture, since I haven't shown you another picture yet, that sort of illustrates what we had on the previous slide. So this is what we're going to be interested in, the language, the classes, and the runtime system, which I had called on the previous slide the JVM. Although this actually includes a few other things like dynamics and security and so on. This is the part that we are going to be concerned with, in particular the language and to a certain extent the classes. surrounding that makes up the idea of protocols which define behaviors in classes and runtimes, for example. Computations, which is what you actually write programs for and are carried out by the runtime. And then security, which is sort of the loving father that overlooks us all to keep us safe. And then around that, you have the various subsystems that I talked about, Jenny and Juxta and all the all the servlets on the, all that stuff that you may or may not have heard about or be familiar with. And then all of that you wrap up and actually write your applications. All right, so this is actually a fairly simplified version of what you actually have to do. If you go to the Sun website and look at their white papers, they have a fairly complex block diagram in which they just unleash the full power of Java, and they have layer upon layer, boxes upon boxes. It's really complicated. This, even though it's highly simplified, is still, there's a lot of structure here. And this sort of gives you your first clue about writing Java. And it's not a trivial thing to do. Writing Java programs is not for the weak at heart or the weak of brain. There are a lot of things you have to do. I was reading something last week, and they were comparing Java to Haskell. And they said that Java is big, but it's big like West Texas. In order to get anywhere, you have to go miles and miles and miles, and it takes you forever. And they said that Haskell was big, but it's big like New York. Right? Everything is piled up on top of everything else. Right? So it's an extremely dense, extremely complicated environment. And I thought that was kind of a nice way to think about things. I mean, you could argue about the metaphor of New York. But certainly, with respect to Java, West Texas is a good way to think about it, where you just have to go miles and miles and miles to get anywhere. And that's kind of illustrated here. And, of course, the reason you have to do that is you have to go through all these things. You have to deal with the subsystems, which in turn means you have to understand the protocols and get the security right and figure out what the computations are going to be. And then you have to write the language part, which is moderated by the protocols and the subsystems. So it can all get fairly complicated. But like I said, we don't have to worry about that. We just have to worry about this part. And in particular, if we take a look at that triangle and break it down into its pieces, we can actually structure it not so much as a triangle, but as a three-layered entity. Although this, again, is more of a, it's perhaps more accurate to think of it as a timeline as opposed to an actual structure of execution. What you start off with is a program. You write a Java program, and then you run it through a Java compiler, and that produces something called a class file. Then what you do is you take your class file, as well as lots of other class files that come from libraries, either the Java libraries or your own or somebody else's, and all of those things get merged together in the JVM, and that's where the execution occurs. So this is the layout of execution in Java. And as the legend shows, the square things are programs, and the elliptical things are data, either programs or class files. And there are some other things here that I'm not talking about. There are, for example, security, what are they called? Security, no, not notifications. I want to say security certificates, but I don't think that's right either. I'm pretty sure it begins with an N. I don't remember. But there are other, and for example, jar files, which are, you can think of as libraries of classes, which we'll talk about when we get to applets, I believe. We do talk about jar files, I believe it's during applets. With respect to your experience in C++, this looks a lot like the way you write C++ code. This is in contrast to your experience with scripting, right, where essentially there's one tight loop here. You write a program, and then you execute it. So we cut out all this stuff in the middle, although, of course, you still have libraries that you can draw on. There's a much tighter integration, for example, with Python or TCL, than there is here, where you have a separate, in a sense, layer that for which you deal with the libraries. So with respect to C and C++, this looks familiar. Now, they place a lot more emphasis on the class libraries in Java than perhaps you have previous experience with in C++. For C++, you pretty much, if I want to use the STL, I include the appropriate headers and you're done. Right? Well, it turns out it's a little bit more complicated in Java. In fact, it can be a lot more complicated in Java, which is why this is broken out as a separate layer in the execution. In the execution diagram here. And again, it's something you have to master. You really need to understand the mechanisms that go on here, in particular the idea of class paths and dynamic loading, in order to be able to understand what Java is doing with your code when it executes it. We will actually come back to this picture in subsequent lectures when we get to fill things in with more detail, but I'll leave it here just to draw on your familiarity with ready C++ code. Okay, so now we can go to the buzzwords. That's sort of the high-level description of what Java is. The textbook has this list of buzzwords that it goes through, and essentially these are the buzzwords: simple, robust, object-oriented, interpreted, architecture-neutral, portable, high-performance, secure, dynamic, distributed, and multi-threaded. And essentially what I've done is I've gone through and I've winnowed out the ones that are either, at least in my point of view, redundant or that we're not going to be concerned with. So principally what we're going to be interested in is the idea of simplicity, robustness, object orientation, of course, and the fact that it's interpreted. We are not going to be that interested in architecture neutral. I justify that by saying that, well, that's essentially equivalent to interpreted. If you actually read what Horstmann says about architecture neutral, that's not quite true. What he's saying is, well, there's this definition that's given by the JVM that determines what execution in Java means. But I chose to interpret this as saying, well, yeah, right. So you know how to interpret class files. So that's taken care of by the interpreter. Portable, again, that's redundant with interpreted. That's not quite true, but for our purposes, it's close enough. High performance, I don't know. I personally, I'm not a high performance person. I don't do high performance computing, so I don't really care. But I have always been skeptical about claims that Java is high performance. I certainly am willing to believe that it's possible to write programs that are high performance in Java. It's just not clear to me how easy that is. But again, we're not going to be concerned about that, so we don't really care. On the other hand, I do actually want to try and avoid low performance, and that's one of the things I'm going to try and talk about when I talk about Java that is really not in the book, is how to avoid writing Java programs that are dog slow, because I've seen plenty of programs like that. You download something from the internet, and you start it up, and you look at a splash screen for 2 minutes. That's not high performance. It's annoying. So I would like to, if I have the opportunity to somehow winnow it in, figure out how to not necessarily avoid those kinds of things, but at least how to recognize what's going on in those cases. A lot of that is user interfacing. It turns out that if you give people things to watch while things go on in background, they don't see it as slow as it actually is. But some of it is actually programming, doing intelligent things with programming. And to the extent that you can think about it that way, then I will try and talk about it that way. Security, again, it's really important, but it's just too complicated. So we're not going to talk about that at all. Dynamic, again, that's for an advanced class. There are a real interesting number of things that you can do with dynamic programming. I was working for a startup at one point, and I was working on a compiler, and one of the things I did was I went through, and if you know about the structure of a compiler, it has a bunch of passes. So what I did was essentially I went through and I rewrote the main part of the compiler so that the passes were dynamically loaded, which meant that you could leave passes in and out depending upon what you wanted to do, which is really nice because some of the passes didn't work. They introduced errors in the intermediate code, which meant that other things downstream didn't work. So if you could just sort of knock those things out from the command line without having to rewrite the compiler, that would be really slick. And everybody didn't really understand what was going on. And eventually what happened was it got dropped. But it was still a pretty slick thing to do. And it's the kind of thing that you can do very easily in Java. So But we're not going to talk about that. That's for a different class. Distributed, that's a different class. That's client-server computing or concurrent programming. And multi-threaded, again, that is concurrent programming. So those are all different classes. So we are essentially going to stick with the simple things, try and write robust code, and object-oriented code, deal with the fact that it's interpreted. All right, so let's take a look at what each one of those things, each one of those buzzwords means with respect to us. Java, the language itself, is simple. And the way I like to think of it, it's a simple language on average. Right, so if you take a look at the individual pieces and figure out whether they're simple or hard, and then you average all those together, the language itself is simple. The problem is, syntactically, Java is too simple. Again, if you're familiar with C++, then you pretty much know what the syntax of Java is, at least in the large, right? It's curly brackets and semicolons. There are some small points, but certainly it's not nearly as bad as C++. The problem is they didn't go far enough. They still have the awful C++ and C, for that matter, case statements, which means essentially, what is the problem with case statements in C++ and C? And similar languages like that, like Java. Yes, switch statements.
You kind of always forget one part of it, or,
Well, that's true, but this is specific to, I mean, that's the case for any language that has case or switch statements. You can always forget a part. But there's something specific that, there's a specific mistake you can make in C++ or Java that you can't make in Pascal or Clue is another language that has a case statement. I don't know. Haskell, I suppose, we can think of having case statements. What's that problem?
Is that you can only compare an integer when you're
That's true. That's true. That's one of the problems. But that's sort of an inconvenience. Can't come and bite you. This problem can come and bite you. That's true, which I guess goes back to, The problem is you need to put an explicit break statement after every branch, because if you don't, one branch falls through to the next. So if you have case one, and you forget to put the break statement at the end of the statements you want to execute for case one, you fall into case two. So you need to put an explicit break after every branch in your case statement. Same thing with Java. They, for some reason, they felt it was important to drag that along. And I don't think so. But so that's an example of where it's too simple. They could have made it a little bit more complex by essentially saying, well, we're going to have a default break here. On the other hand, the system, Java, the system, is not simple. In particular, navigating your way around the class library can be very complicated. As well as, for example, understanding security. But like I said, we're not going to be talking about security. Understanding pretty much anything in Java is a complicated task, which is a lot of the reason why we're not talking about most of it. But of the things that we are going to be considering, certainly the most complicated is the class library. And trying to figure your way around the class library can be a difficult thing to do. So if you take all these things and you average them together, you get a simple language, but it's the pieces that's the problem. The semantics is also a little bit more complicated than it could be. They could have had simpler semantics, but I guess to a certain extent that was conditioned on their need to have various aspects of security embodied, for example, in the language, in the runtime system, and so on. I mentioned earlier that when I was talking about how I should teach this class, whether I should talk about objects primarily or Java primarily, there's a relationship between object-oriented programming and Java. And it's a fairly fundamental one, and this slide illustrates what that relationship is. Java, the language itself, is mostly object-oriented. Okay. Almost everything that you can deal with is an object. Now, there is an exception to that, which is unfortunate, and is one of those examples where the semantics is more complicated than it should be. The basic types, like int and bool and so forth, are not objects. Okay, now this actually turns out to be not such a big deal anymore, because with, I believe, Java 5, I'm pretty sure it wasn't Java 4, but certainly at least by Java 5, they have this notion of boxing and unboxing that goes on automatically. So this fact here actually is not as important as it was at one point, or is not as annoying as it was at one point. But still, you can still trip over the fact that you have different types, particularly when you talk about generics. Java the system is also object-oriented, and this is actually where the power of object-oriented systems really comes out, when you deal with Java as a distributed system. Thinking about Java behind the browser or just sitting on a desktop doesn't really illustrate the power associated with Java. It's when you get to writing distributed systems that Java really becomes the importance of all these things that seem complicated and hard to deal with. It really starts to shine. But unfortunately, like I said, we're not going to be talking about that in this class. So this is one place at which I wonder, do I have a comparison here? I was thinking about adding a comparison to C++ explicitly. No, I guess I didn't. So this is one place where C++ and Java diverge. I mean, in the case of, I guess the way Stroustrup likes to put it, in C++, what does he say? He doesn't say it's an object-oriented program. He says it supports the object-oriented paradigm. Okay, which, I don't know, is a whole bunch of weasel words. I'm not quite sure what they mean. But essentially, one of the things they mean is that you don't have to write object-oriented programming. In other words, you can write C++ programs that don't have any objects at all. You can essentially write C++ like it was C. You don't have that option in Java. Well, you can pretend that you don't have that option in Java. In fact, what you will be doing is you'll be writing classes and creating, in a sense, singleton instances of those classes using static methods and all this other stuff. If you squint very hard, you can pretend that you're writing C++ or C code, but that's extremely bad programming in Java. And you shouldn't do it. Unfortunately, in certain cases, you were forced to do it, which is one of the reasons I don't like Java. Again, it's the semantic complexity versus the syntactic simplicity. So this is the relationship between objects and Java. This is why I wasn't too worried about not, favoring one over the other, because they are so closely related that it's a question of, actually almost a question of taste, which one you want to emphasize more, Java in particular or object-oriented programming in particular. Robustness is actually going to be another place where you have a divergence between, I was almost going to say C++, but that's actually not quite true, Unix-style programming and Java. Java programs have a set of expected error sources. Right? This is one of the things it means when you say that a program or a system is robust. Not only should it not fail, okay, but if it does fail, you should understand where it will fail. And that sounds kind of contradictory, but if you think about it, it's not possible to write programs that don't fail. Why is that? Well, let me put it this way. I'm sorry, let me change that and give you a little hint. It's not possible to write non-trivial programs that don't fail. And why is that?
So you don't really know what you're going to get in.
That's true. That's right. Now, make that more general. Why don't you know what you are going to get in?
Because the problem is more general and you can't program for every single instance.
That's true, but why do I need to worry about doing that? Why, this is for positive numbers, right? So why do I need to worry about negative numbers?
Somebody can potentially put a negative number in.
Right. Now, what is this somebody you're talking about?
The user.
That's true, but
who doesn't know how you wrote the program?
Right, but the user is embedded in what? I'm trying to get another name for the user. There's a more dignified term for user that I'm trying to move you towards. Because there may not be a user, right? You may be writing software that goes in an airplane or a car, for that matter. And that's why I said non-trivial programs. The environment. Non-trivial programs are embedded in an environment that is separate from the program itself. And therefore, it cannot control, the program itself cannot control the kinds of inputs it gets from the environment, nor can it control the way in which the environment reacts to the outputs. Okay, that's why you can't write programs that don't make mistakes, because the program itself has no control over the environment in which it executes. Okay, that's one of the nice things about the JVM. The JVM says, well, that's true, but for the part that actually executes your program, I'm going to define that. Okay, and that, to the extent that you can do that, that makes Java programs more robust when you compare them to, for example, C++. Because in C++, there's all kinds of things, and in particular in C, because it's an older language, there are all kinds of things that are left up to the environment, but these things are crucial, such as whether or not characters are signed or unsigned. Right? That's entirely an environmental feature in C. I'm not sure about C++. And of course, if you get different answers, then that could have a significant effect on the way your program behaves. The other characteristic is that, given that you have control over it, to the extent that you can have control over it, the set is smaller and simpler than the sets for some other languages. In particular, in Java, you don't have direct access to pointers, right? Which means that we have suddenly thrown out an entire class of problems that kill students in C and C++, and that is explicit pointer manipulation. That's handed off to the runtime system, let the runtime system take care of it. On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean that there are no pointer problems. There are, in fact. But they now become harder to deal with because they are obscured by a layer of, I don't know what you want to call it, abstraction, I suppose, is one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is protection, I suppose, if you want to think of it that way. So you can have problems, for example, retaining garbage, things, instances that you don't need anymore, but you can still access, which means they won't be garbage collected. So you have to be careful about dealing with those kinds of issues. And then, of course, there's the usual C++ boneheadedness that's still around. For example, I mentioned the case statements. On the other hand, given that you have all these nice features, that still doesn't absolve you of responsibility, because programs that abort in an orderly fashion with exceptions are just as useless as programs that abort with a core dump. What this does is it makes it easier for you to understand what your problems are and to fix them. For example, array accesses in Java are protected. So if you actually do something like access a sub minus 1 or a sub n, you will get an exception, as opposed to C and C++, where it just says, oh, okay, I can do that. In fact, A sub n is a legal reference in some circumstances. A sub minus 1 never is. So a program that fails because you didn't detect the fact that you're accessing and writing to A sub minus 1 is no different from a program that throws an exception because you actually do that. Again, it's your job as a programmer to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I will actually, and I'm working on this even as we speak, I am modifying the JVM because I noticed a little trick, and I will tell you this now because it really annoyed me, and it also annoyed the students when they saw the effect it had on their programming grades. A lot of students were throwing null pointer exceptions, array access exceptions, and they weren't fixing them. They were just catching them and ignoring them. That is very bad. Your code will not pass if I see that. And I'm modifying the JVM so that it finds those things and prints them out. It says, oh, you know, this program executed, and they had 250 null pointer exceptions. Right? You should not have a single null pointer exception, and you should not have a single array access exception. And I'm going to modify the JVM so that it checks to make sure that's the case. I'll just give you this. I mean, you may not even know what I'm talking about because I'm talking about things that we haven't considered yet. But, and I will be mentioning this over and over again, but I was actually, I stumbled across this by accident too. So that's something that will not fly this semester. I'll just warn you of that now. Okay, interpretation. The interpreter, the Java virtual machine or the JVM, is, in a sense, the heart of the Java system. This is the execution engine. Most of the system benefits flow from using the JVM. And you, if you remember back on that list of buzzwords, I crossed a lot of them off and said, ah, that's because of interpretation. Right? Now, that's again, that was perhaps a little too cavalier, but nonetheless, there's a certain amount of truth in that. It's not the entire truth. In addition to all the nice things that you get, architecture neutrality, portability, the ability to have distributed computations, you do have some problems that come along with that. And some of the problems include performance, the fact that you're interpreting code as opposed to executing it natively. These problems that you can have with the JVM are not going to bother us. And it turns out that I put this in last year because I wasn't quite sure whether we were going to have problems with security or not. And we didn't, so I assume we were lucky. But I left it in just as a warning. We could, in fact, have problems with security in the sense that we want to, and the reason I mention this is because the programming assignments, I haven't actually decided whether or not they will be separate assignments or they will be a continuous assignment. And if it's a continuous assignment, I was actually looking at some kind of distributed game where essentially what would happen is I would give you a distributed game and then rip pieces out of it and let you put the pieces back in. And if we do that, then we have to worry about security because essentially what would happen is anybody could connect up to this game and do stuff, and we would have to make sure that that is either a trivial action which has no consequences, or if it does have consequences, it's a secure action. But to the extent possible, I mean, I assume that we will be operating in the friendly environment of the Mammoth domain, although actually it might be nice to throw it out into the harsh and wild world out there. We may or may not have to deal with this. Well, actually, I will attempt to shield you from this as much as possible. But like I said, we may have to come face to face with the ugly beast of security. Okay, a little bit of history, because I think it's useful to know history. And also, it serves to understand why Java is the way it is, particularly if you're familiar with other object-oriented languages. How many people know about other object-oriented languages? For example? Well, C++, of course.
ActionScript, what that's like.
That's the Flash... Smalltalk, that's fine, yeah. In fact, that's the hardcore object-oriented language Smalltalk is. Well, if you're familiar with other object-oriented languages, I mean, to a certain extent, Java is similar, but also to a certain extent, it's different. And it's interesting to consider its history as a justification, or at least an understanding of why it's different. So starting in 1991, some people at Sun began to develop a language for network consumer devices. They had this idea that the world was moving towards, this was when cable was hot, and it looked like the world was moving towards the idea of a set-top box. And so people were trying very hard to get their hardware and software into these set-top boxes, because if they do that, then of course you sell one to everybody in the world and you're rich. So they developed a language which I guess, at least if I'm remembering correctly, started off being called Green and then changed the name to Oak, and then finally changed the name to Java. They came up with a language in 1992, and they tried to market it, and it failed. So they tried again as a spin-off, and it failed again. Okay, it spun off from Sun. I forget what the name of the company was. And they tried to get it to fly, and it didn't. And when it failed, they brought the people back into Sun. And then they had a success. They hit on the idea of putting Java in the browser. Okay, and they developed what was called at the time the Hot Java Browser. So the idea was, rather than running programs in these little boxes, you could run programs in your browser. And of course, that turned out to be wildly successful, the idea that you could write things in the browser and have arbitrary programs running. So that started their success. But the important, so what's the, how would you characterize the devices here? I mean, how would you characterize the environment? I said one of the things that you didn't have control over as a programmer is the environment in which your program runs. Right? So looking at this, what kind of environment did Java start off with? What kind of environment was it aiming for?
Networked.
Right. But how would you characterize that? Well, that's true. That's true. It's networked.
Embedded.
Okay, and could you give us a little bit more concrete characterization of embedded?
Doesn't have to adapt to a lot of different programming.
Right.
Programmers.
Right.
It's set so to be in, like, set top boxes.
Right. You have a controlled environment, but what else can you say about the environment in particular?
Real time.
It's real time. Well, soft real time, let's call it. Although it could have hard real time components.
Barely controlled.
It's controlled, right. So. But more importantly, there's one that you haven't mentioned that's important. It's small, right? You don't have a lot of space. You have, you know, 16 meg of RAM, maybe, and 32 meg of ROM or something like that. You have a small 8-bit microprocessor. You have an underpowered environment. You have a small environment. And I think that, and this is my opinion, I don't really have any way to back it up other than just by looking at consistency between what you have now and where it came from. This had an effect on the ability to write programs in the large. Okay, because that's not something you worry about when you're writing an environment, a programming environment for set-top boxes, limited devices. You don't have to worry about writing big, huge programs. But of course, that's what people are using Java for now, is to write big, huge programs. And that's another reason I don't like Java, is because it's really hard, or at least I haven't quite figured out how, to write big, huge programs nicely in Java. This is one of the reasons I'm talking about history, is because I want to sort of impress upon you the fact that it came from an environment in which it is not currently successful. So you would anticipate that there would be mismatches along the way, and in fact, at least to my eye, those mismatches are fairly clear. So it found a successful home in the browser, and then the marketing people took over, and of course at that point it was screwed. Right, so they introduced Java 1.0 as a proof of concept, which was completely useless. You weren't able to do anything. And so what they had to do is they had to go back and fix it up. And so they released 1.1, which fixed a few things up, but really didn't improve things that much. And then in 1998, they released Java 1.2, which is the first really useful version of Java that came out. So unlike, was it F. Scott Fitzgerald who said that there are no second acts in American, you don't get second acts in America? Well, Java got actually three, or four maybe if you count these other ones up here. And of course at this point it became well-hyped. Right? And from that point of view you can argue it's successful. But down here it actually became something that was tangible and concrete. And in fact you will still see people who are writing code to the 1.1 standard, because that's the sort of minimal useful configuration of Java you can expect to have supported. I was actually, at one point, I got a wiki that was written in Java, and the person who wrote the wiki was very careful to use only 1.1 features so that it would be supported by any browser that you wanted to run it on. And I modified the wiki to do things that I was interested in doing, and I tried to follow the 1.1 standard. And it turns out there are some commands in Java, the Java compiler, you can do that will help you do that. But after a while, it's just like, oh man, this is too much work. So I just said, screw it, and I just went up to at the time I was fooling around with this, it was 1.4. So you got all kinds of nice things like assertions and regular expressions, things like that. But you still occasionally run across code that's written to the 1.1 to make sure that there is browser compatibility.
Aren't there like deprecated classes in 1.1?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is the other thing that amazes me, and I really go into it when I teach concurrent programming, because the entire thread system stinks, and it stinks in exactly the way it should not stink, because they were like Microsoft in the sense they made every mistake you could possibly make that everybody else has already made. So there was actually no justification for making these mistakes. Right? I mean, canceling a thread, that is stupid. Of course you can't cancel a thread because you don't know anything about its state, right? But they have a thread cancel. So of course they had to deprecate it. But my question is, why did they put it in there in the first place? That's just a small portion of my rant when I talk about threading. But yeah, you're right. There are classes that are deprecated all the time. And they don't even follow their own standard is the other thing you'll notice, even for the classes that are not deprecated. So, all right, so Java has ended up in, one way to look at it, Java has ended up in essentially four main environments. All right, so there are essentially four main environments for running Java programs. The first one is the browser, and these are applets. Okay, now, this actually does not happen so much these days, which is kind of unfortunate, but I can understand exactly why that's the case. Although I haven't updated yet, I'm going to... Because what happened is, when we talk about Swing, I actually embedded Swing applets in my lecture notes so that I could show you what, for example, drop-down menus look like, and it didn't work. It was so embarrassing. You know, it would work at home, and then I'd bring it in, and I click, and the thing would just explode or something like that. And I'll try it again this semester and see, maybe, because they're supposed to have improved the applets or the Java runtime system for browsers, but it just didn't work, which was unfortunate. But that's the first environment. The second environment is the server, all right, on the other side of the server. So, and essentially, there's the two ends of the World Wide Web, right? There's the end that's in front of your browser, and then there's the end that's behind the server. So in that sense, that's sort of the environment that Java works. Examples of those are the JSP, the Java server pages, where you can write combinations, unholy combinations of HTML and Java. When does this class end? 3:50?
Yeah.
So that's like 25 minutes. Okay, I just want to make sure, because I see people walking by. I just want to make sure. So Java server pages, servlets, and frameworks. For example, the Juxta and Jinny and things like that. This is actually Java's widest view. This is what's known as the J2EE, Java Enterprise Edition. I'm not going to talk at all about that, but when you look at job postings and you see they want Java programmers, they almost always want J2EE programmers, and it's for doing things like this. And then there's the desktop, which is the regular programs that you might want to run. For example, OpenOffice is written in Java. Other things are written in Java. And these are sort of the normal kinds of programs that you would think of writing on your own. And my interpretation is that Java is winning over C++ because it is a simpler language, particularly with respect to garbage collection. That is the principal reason why Java is winning over C++, is the fact that you don't have to do garbage collection. It's not clear what's happening in Microsoft. Of course, Microsoft doesn't really give you good support for Java, but they have ripped it off enough in terms of C# that you can think of that as perhaps a backhanded complement to Java. Although now they play games, of course. You know, one C#, for example, introduces generics, and then Java in the next revision introduces generics, and so forth and so on. The fourth environment are portables, which is another really important, or at least growing in importance, at least in theory anyway, environment for Java. So these would be things like cell phones, PDAs, perhaps the Kindles. Did anybody have a Kindle? I got a Kindle for Christmas, and it's written in Java. Or it's not clear to me how much is written in Java, but if you get the Kindle user's guide and you turn it over, there's a little Java logo in the corner. So I assume that there's some Java going on in there. This is unclear but promising. Last year, I tried to get a version of Java called ME for Micro Edition, which is the version of Java that runs on cell phones and other limited environment devices. And man, I could not figure out how to make it work. So we didn't do that. And we're not going to do it this semester either, because I have other things to fiddle around with, like the JVM and so forth. But there is a Java subsystem called Java ME, which you can use to create Java code that runs on cell phones and other kinds of environments. If I could actually get it to work, it would be really slick, because then you'd be able to write things that you could download. And how many people have a Java-enabled cell phone? You have one? What is it?
It's just a Motorola Riser.
Okay.
It's typically run Java apps.
Have you actually done that?
I've tried to also, and I got nowhere with it.
It's I got this book, and the reason I did this is because about this time last year I got a book to review, which was Writing Games in Java, and I said, oh, how providential. So I went through the book and I wrote the review, and then I went back and tried to actually download the stuff, and everything worked fine up until I got something wrong, and then I was just completely lost, so I couldn't, and it's really complicated, it's amazing. But in fact, I wrote that in the review because one of the things, it's kind of like, and in fact, I started a review by saying that one of my favorite chess cartoons is there are these two people who are standing by a counter in a department store, and there's a chessboard laid out on the table, right? And there are pieces on the chessboard. And the clerk is saying to the customer, it's easy. All you have to do is move these pieces around. And I said, that's my favorite game, because this book started off by saying that, okay, first of all, you have to make sure that your cell phone provider has their web server set up correctly. So you want to make sure that you get your web server to set you want to make sure you get your cell provider to set their web server up this way. I said, oh, that's easy. Just go to Verizon and tell them they have to run their web server this way. Yeah, I'll do that right away. But if you can actually get it to work, it would be pretty slick. And of course, you can also do simulation. I couldn't get that to work either. You can download a simulator, and I couldn't get that to work. So it was just nothing worked anywhere. So I gave up on it. All right, this is something we need to take care of. Java is not equal to JavaScript. Okay, they are essentially completely unrelated languages. Netscape used JavaScript just to annoy Sun. Right? They were going back and forth. It was, what's his name, Clark, Jim Clark at Netscape, and then, I don't know who was at Sun at the time. What was that guy's name? See how quickly they forget. Scott McNeely, was that it? At Sun. And they were just going back and forth about embedding things in the browser and having this execution environment. And they came up with this language, sort of a language for scripting the browser, which they called JavaScript because they wanted to annoy Sun, because Sun was giving them a hard time about including Java in the browser as the language to use. So the only reason it's called JavaScript is to annoy Sun. It has absolutely no relationship to Java itself. All right, so that's the first thing. Right? We're not going to talk about JavaScript at all. JavaScript is actually now properly called ECMAScript for the European Computer Manufacturers Association. Right, that's what you're actually supposed to call JavaScript, although, of course, no one does this. All right, so that's the relationship between Java and JavaScript. Essentially, there is none. Now, in my opinion, in a browser, Java is a win, and JavaScript is a loss. Okay, and the reason for that is JavaScript is wildly unsecure, and it will always be so. It is essentially impossible to type JavaScript programs. And if you can't type the program, then essentially you can't say anything about it. And if you can't say anything about it, it's unsecure. And so from that point of view, JavaScript is just completely unacceptable if you're talking about downloading programs from who knows where and executing them, because you don't know what you're getting, and you can't possibly know what you're getting. On the other hand, JavaScript is simpler and faster, and it's already in the browser. Okay, so in a sense, it wins, regardless of the fact that it's completely insecure. Java, unfortunately, is none of these things. It's really complicated to get Java going, and it certainly isn't simple, and it is in no sense faster. On the other hand, it is secure, and in fact, it's secure in the way in which you would want these programs to be secure. You're downloading arbitrary code from who knows where, and you want to run it. Well, Java lets you say the things that you want to be able to say about that program to make sure that it's something you'd actually want to run. So from that point of view, I believe that the correct way to go is to go with Java, not JavaScript. Unfortunately, I can understand perfectly why people don't do that. Here's another thing that tends to annoy me. James Gosling has written a paper, I think it's called The Feel of Java. There's a reference at the end. We can figure out what it is. But James Gosling has called JavaScript a blue-collar programming language. Right? And the question is, what does that mean? What is a blue-collar programming language? And if you read the paper, in a negative sense, it means it's not a PhD-driven research language, right? It's not like Haskell, where you got all these really smart people saying, oh, wow, let's stick monads in here, and let's do general data types now, and you know. But that's a negative point of view. More positively, it's a language for working programmers to get things done, which, if you think about it, is kind of redundant, because who writes programming? Well, actually, there are people that write programming languages that it's very hard to get things done. But apart from those pathological cases, most people write programming languages to get things done. But you will occasionally hear it said that Java is a blue-collar programming language, and that's where it comes from. It comes from Gosling. Gosling is one of the people who was in at the beginning in the development of Java and remains in up to this day. He still works for Sun. He still does the evangelical thing. But there is one important thing I want to point out here, and that is this idea that blue-collar is equal to stupid. And that's not true. And I ran across this, I mean, you run across it on occasion, but I ran across it a lot when people were talking about, and people still are to a certain extent, although not as much as they used to be, the issue of adding closures to Java. Now, I don't know how many people know what a closure is. I'm not gonna tell you what it is if you don't know, but it's a feature that people wanted to add to Java. If you add closures to Java, I think it would be a really nice feature to add, although the way they added generics makes me a little nervous. But if Java had closures, it would be really fun to program in, which it's not. It's really not fun to program in Java. You can take a certain amount of, I don't want to say pride, but it's not fun. I mean, if I want to have fun writing programs, I don't write in Java because that's not the language to do it in. But if it had closures, it would be fun to write programs in Java. Okay. However, I've repeatedly read when people were talking about whether or not closures should be in Java, people would say things like, Java programmers won't understand what closures are, so you should not put them in. Okay, and I thought that was an extremely bad argument for not having closures. Right? Because first of all, who knows if it's true or not? But secondly, even if it is, if people don't know what they are, they can learn. Right? And this goes back to the idea that, well, you know, it's a blue-collar programming language and blue-collar people are stupid. Well, that's not true at all. And that's just a really bad argument. So you should be on guard for that kind of argument. And the reason it's important is because one of the design principles that the people who developed Java had was they had a minimal language. Right? They took C++ and then they threw stuff out. And then they would not put stuff back in because they would say things like, well, you can do that. Right. One of the things they don't do, which is extremely annoying, is it's very hard to return more than one value from a procedure or a method. Actually, there are no procedures. Right. So if you wanted to return, for example, a Boolean value to indicate validity and the actual value, that's very hard to do. You can do it, but you have to go through a lot of work. This is what I mean by it not being fun to program in Java. And people said, you should make it easier to return multiple values from methods. And the designer said, no, you can do that. And you haven't shown me that it's really necessary. And since you can do it other ways, we're not going to add it to the language. So to a certain extent, Java is a really poor programming language in the sense that it doesn't have a lot of the features you would expect a modern programming language to have. And the task of adding those features is long and arduous, right? That's why it didn't have generics. And they eventually put generics in, and that's why people are arguing over closures now. And I suspect closures will not end up in Java. So there are things that aren't in Java that people want to be in Java, and so they make proposals. What it's called the Java community process, I believe. You propose that this feature be added, and then they throw it up, and people go hammer on it and various things. But you will frequently see this argument, oh, no, we don't need this because Java programmers won't understand it. And that's just snobbery. That's not good. I mean, I'm a snob, but this is snobbery in excess of even what I would countenance. So that's one reason I talk about this, is because you read about it, you may hear it on occasion, this is where it came from, but you have to be wary of this argument. The other reason I talk about it is because, right, we have blue collar, what else do you have? What's sort of the opposite of blue collar? You have white collar, right? And white collar are the bureaucrats, are the bosses. And it seems to me that Java, you know, you could argue about whether or not it's a blue collar language. However, there is absolutely no argument. Java is absolutely a white-collar language. Object-oriented systems can be bureaucratic organizations, right? And with all the bad all the bad thoughts that bureaucrats and bureaucratic organizations bring into play, Positively, a bureaucracy organizes and streamlines complexity, right? That's why you have the division of motor vehicles. In theory, anyway, it makes it easy for you to get a license, it makes it easy for you to register your car, get plates, get inspected. Okay? That's the theory. Now, of course, everybody laughed when I said that. The practice, on the other hand, is that negatively, a bureaucracy is inflexible and it's very expensive to go off the path. Right? If you're a Chinese national and your license has expired, you have a lot of work to do to get your license back, right? Even more so than you would if you were just a regular American citizen, right? Because that's something strange. Chinese nationals, ooh, they don't even have a driver's license, right? So you need to actually go completely outside the normal expertise of the bureaucracy, and that is extremely painful. You will see that with respect to Java. We're not just going to deal with frameworks here, but if you deal with frameworks that don't do quite what you want them to do, now you've got a really long road to hoe. Or long row to hoe, I suppose I should say. And part of the reason for that is the way that the object-oriented features are set up are inflexible. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. You can actually write flexibility into your environment, but you have to do that explicitly. It's not something you can recover on your own. To a certain extent, this course is going to reject this idea of a bureaucratic point of view. But unfortunately, we can't avoid it because of the inherent object-oriented nature of Java. Okay, to summarize, Java is a system, not just a language, although we are going to spend most of our time talking about language here. In some areas, compared to some languages, Java is okay. I mean, that's about as far as I'm willing to go. On the other hand, the JVM is slick. It's really slick. You should really learn about the JVM. There are a couple of books I can give you. I think at least one of them is in the bibliography, the annotated bibliography. But you should really learn how to write JVM assembly programs, class files, and then perhaps even write a compiler that goes into JVM code. That's a lot of fun, too. Java wanted to be everywhere. It wanted to, as they said at one point, was it write once, run everywhere. And it may actually still. They may actually achieve that goal, although in a different way than they had originally intended. And finally, Java is not equal to JavaScript. And quite possibly, at least in my opinion, Java is better than JavaScript. Although, in its current incarnation, that's a hard thing to perhaps justify. Any questions? The Feel of Java by Gosling, IEEE Computer, The New Thing by Michael Lewis. Has anybody read this book? This is an excellent book, but the reason I have it here is because it goes into the interplay. This is actually a book about Jim Clark, who was quite a guy. And it goes into the interplay between Clark when he was at Netscape and McNeely when he was at Sun. A couple of chapters in there about those two going back and forth. But overall, it's a pretty interesting book to read. All right, any questions? If there are no questions, then we're done. I'll see you on Thursday.